This is Alex Voorhoeven from LSE. He sent his paper along. Some of you will have read it, some of you won't have. I've read it. It's really good, like all of Alex's work. And so over to you.
Well, thanks very much, and thank you all very much for coming today. And a special thank you to those of you who struggled through the paper. You're jumping straight into the middle of season 4, episode 5 of Game of Thrones, basically, where the throne is the theory of distributive justice. Which one gets to call itself king, right? Utilitarianism, prioritarianism, egalitarianism, sufficientarianism, or some other such ism. And if you'd started reading the paper from the start, you might have wondered, you know, what is this? You know, why? Who are these dragons? And why is the little guy so angry with his dad? All those details, since writing the paper, Mike Otsuka and I, who first started a debate with prioritarianism or a criticism of a particular line of criticism of prioritarianism 6 years ago, recently tried to give a kind of overview of the debate so far. So if you're interested in the backstory, in previous episodes version without the blood and swords and soft porn of the original, you can read this paper on my website. So I will at some point make some references to key ideas of previous debates, but the paper does try to move into new territory, which I'll define in a moment. So this is what you're meant to imagine, that you're a private donor of resources for healthcare, and these resources are of no particular use to you, though they can be of use to others. And you're in the fortunate position that the gifts that you can bestow on others cannot harm. They may be ineffective, but they can never do harm, and they may benefit people to varying degrees. And this is what, in all the examples I'll be discussing today, your actions will determine, namely the expected well-being of people who exist. In some of the examples, they may determine the identities of the people who will exist, but they will never determine the number of people who will exist. In other words, the type of cases we're looking at today, which is what we're trying to push our previous arguments and look at the various theories, is what I'm going to be calling risky, because the outcome of your actions are not certain. Non-identity, because who exists may also be uncertain, at least in some of the cases, but fixed number cases. So we're not dealing with cases in which the number of people will change, so we don't have to value changes in population. We're parking that very complex and difficult question aside in this paper. So what is an example that to get us going? Well, here's the example with which we start the paper, and let me explain a bit what this table means. There's two potential people, Anne and Bob. At the top of the table you see the state of the world, either S1 or S2, and between brackets the probability that this state of the world will come about. And this probability doesn't depend, in this case, on your actions. In fact, in none of the cases I'll be discussing today does the probability of anyone coming into existence depend on your actions. It's given. You have to act not knowing whether Anne or Bob will come into existence. And your choice is between these two prospects. Prospect one means that if Anne comes into existence, she has a well-being level of 50. If Bob comes into existence, he has a well-being level of 70. Prospect 2 means that if Anne comes into existence, she has a well-being level of 60, and Bob comes into existence, he has a well-being level of 60. Now, at the very start of papers in distributive ethics or distributive justice, if one's going to use numbers like this, one has to make some assumptions about what they mean. So here's what we're going to take them to mean. Obviously, in terms of an increase in well-being or prudential value for the person, This is a cardinal scale, so going from 50 to 60 does and just as much good as going from 60 to 70 does for Bob. And as we'll move on to some risky one-person cases, I'll also explain that this equal increase means that if Anne herself faced a gamble between an increase of 50 from 50 to 60, or instead an increase from 60 to 70, the numbers mean that she would be indifferent on her own behalf between two such increases. So, equal increases in prudential value, and we're assuming, for those of you who know what I'm referring to, the von Neumann Morgenstern conception of utility here, on which, what does it mean for something to be an equal increase from 50 to 60 and from 60 to 70? That's if someone didn't know if they were at 50 or at 60, they could get a 10 unit increase, right? They would be indifferent between the two increases. Okay, so that's what these numbers mean. So, what ought you to do in a case like this? Well, Mike Otsuka, my colleague at LSE and fellow battler against the evil prioritarians, says, in this case, you should choose prospect 2. You might ask yourself at this moment, do you agree? So only one person will ever come into existence. It'll either be out like that or equal, no matter who comes into existence. I agree. I would choose prospect 2 in this case. The aim of today's talk, is to find a view that gets this case and other cases that I'll be looking at correct, and that has an attractive deep rationale. So we're not just looking to fit for a theory that fits the cases, but that has a deep underlying unified view of distributive ethics. Now, obviously, in this case, it can't be utilitarianism. If you take this judgment for granted, which I will be taking as the right judgment in this paper, it can't be utilitarianism because the expected utility of either one is the same. Now, Mike, interestingly, argues that it cannot be egalitarianism either. Why is that? Well, only one person will ever come into existence. So, favoring prospect 2 doesn't make anyone more equal to anyone else who will also exist, who will coexist with them. So long as we focus on this mini-world bracketing everyone else, there is no egalitarian reason, Mike claims, for favoring 2/1. So, now here's the problem for people like me, who's been arguing for 6 years that prioritarianism is wrong. Prioritarianism seems an excellent candidate in this case. Right? Why is that? Well, the prioritarian says there's more moral value in an increase from 50 to 60 than there is in an increase from 60 to 70. So we create greater expected priority-weighted moral value by going for prospect 2. So you can see why this case is troubling. To me, anyway, to those prioritarians in the room, this may be deeply satisfying. We could end the talk there. So here's my plan for today. First, I think there are some questions about how exactly to develop prioritarianism for such cases. So the first part of the talk is to do the best job I can on behalf of prioritarianism to spell out a prioritarian view for these risky non-identity fixed number cases. And I'm going to argue that it fails. Not in this case, it gets this case right, but that it gets several other cases wrong. And then the second part of my talk is to propose an egalitarian view which does succeed. So the case to begin with seems to favor prioritarianism over egalitarianism. I'm going to argue that the best prioritarian view in the end fails, and that there is an egalitarian view which gets this case right and others, and which has an attractive deep rationale, the rationale being proper respect for the difference, or let me put it this way, proper respect for both the unity of the individual and the separateness of persons. That way of putting the slogan, by the way, I owe to Tom Porter in one of his early papers. Okay, so prioritarianism for possible people. Let's first find out the best prioritarian view that we can. Just to remind you, I don't assume that everyone here has drunk deep from the prioritarian cup. What is prioritarianism? Well, one version is final utility prioritarianism that pays attention only to final outcomes. Here's a way of defining the view. Each person's final utility has diminishing marginal moral value. That's the way Parfit puts it in his well-known talk. So what does that mean? If we put our utility outcomes here, and we put moral value on a different axis, we see the increase in moral value if you move someone's utility from 50 to 60 is this. The increase in moral value if you move someone else, or the same person, from 60 to 70 is this. This is smaller than that. Right. So we get a diminishing marginal moral value. And what do we do under risk? We simply maximize, we assume, here throughout the paper, whatever your view of value is that you're targeting, under risk, you should maximize the expectation. That's what standard decision theory says. I'd be happy to discuss what would follow if we did a non-standard decision theory, but I don't think the debate between egalitarians and prioritarians should hang on whether or not we also accept standard decision theory. So basically, maximizing the expectation just means you maximize the probability-weighted moral value of your action. So, here's an objection to final utility prioritarianism. And this is old stuff. I'm going to run through it quickly, but because it's useful background. The objection is that it doesn't respect the difference between the unity of the individual and the separateness of persons. And what do we mean by this? Let me give you an example. Suppose one of the choices you can make, this is a case in which people will exist for sure, so no non-identity cases, is that Dave and Ali both get 60 for sure, or instead you can choose to let Dave expose him to a gamble. And the gamble is that he might end up with less, or he might end up with more than he might otherwise have. And D is meant to be positive. And note that Ellie is not concerned at all in this choice. So she doesn't care whether you choose prospect 5 or prospect 6. So let's focus on Dave for the moment. Now here it matters what these numbers mean. On the measure of utility that we're assuming, for any D larger than 0, prospect 6 is what you would prefer on Dave's behalf, just focusing on what's good for him. That's what the measure means. So it's a question of by definition. So whenever D is larger than 0, in terms of justifying prospect 6 to Dave, you have a prudential justification to him. Suppose you choose prospect 6 and it goes wrong, you can say, I'm sorry, I was aiming at doing the best I could for you, given what I knew. Given my knowledge, I was focusing on your well-being alone and trying to do the best I could for you under limited knowledge. So prospect 6 of the prospect 5 has a strong prudential justification. And in that case, since it's a case of purely intrapersonal trade-offs, why? Because Ellie has nothing at stake, only Dave has something at stake, and what we're trading off is a chance of him ending less well off than he otherwise might, with a chance of him ending better off than he otherwise might. So I would say choose your D. This is an exercise for you. Choose your D here so that it's the smallest at which you think it's just barely permissible to go for prospect 6. So you might think about this. There may be reasons for having D somewhat significantly larger than 0, perhaps that there will be some inequality between the people here. And this inequality isn't generated by people's choices, not by the choices of Dave and Ellie, who are unconcerned, and we can imagine them to be children, so we don't have to respect their autonomy. Okay, so choose some D so that you think 6 is just barely permissible. Now suppose that you learn something new. You thought you were choosing between prospect 5 and prospect 6, but in fact, what happens is, if you choose the risky prospect, and it goes, things don't go well, it's true, Dave stays the same, he's still at 50, but the benefits go to Ellie. So if things go less well than you hope, the harms fall on Dave. If they go well, the benefits come to Ellie. Now, this has now become an interpersonal case. And we think that in this case, it's much harder to justify choosing prospect 7 than it was to choose prospect 6 before. Why? Because you no longer have the prudential justification to Dave. If things go wrong, all you can say to Dave is, I exposed you to a risk of ending less well off than you otherwise might have been, in order to give Ellie a chance at a greater benefit, thereby ensuring that no matter what happens, she will end up better off than you. And we think that is much harder to justify. The first case, I'll now put them all back up, choosing between prospect 5 and 6. 6 is much easier to justify than 7 rather than 5. So here's the claim. There is a level of a larger benefit here for which prospect 6 compared to prospect 5 is permissible because it's a purely intrapersonal trade-off, but 7 rather than 5 is not permissible. And that tracks the difference between the unity of the individual and the separateness of persons. Now, pure outcome prioritarianism, final utility prioritarianism, does not distinguish between choosing prospect 6 when 5 is the alternative and 7 when 5 is the alternative, because the final distribution of utility or moral value is the same in both cases. Someone will be at 50, someone at 60, or instead someone will be at 60 and someone at 70 plus D. So if you focus only on the moral value of the outcomes, you don't see any difference in this case. So, final utility prioritarianism cannot accommodate this. What's the conclusion that Parfit himself draws in a utility class article responding to a case like this? We should give weight to both final utility and expected utility. So I'm going to call that hybrid prioritarianism. Both final utility matters and expected utility matter. They matter independently. They're both independent components of the currency of justice. And each of them has diminishing marginal moral value. So how does that solve a case like this? Well, it respects this difference. How? Well, you see here, Dave has higher expected utility, right? Then Ellie's expected utility is 60. Dave's is slightly over 60. Here, we have Dave's expected utility at 55 and Ellie's at somewhat over 65, so we have greater differences in the expected utilities. So if we give priority not merely to low utility outcomes, but also low expected utilities, independently of the significance of outcomes, we can easily favor this, which distributes expected utilities more equally over this. So, hybrid prioritarianism gets this case right and some other cases, and it therefore respects this difference between the unity of the individual and the separateness of persons, the difference between intra and interpersonal trade-offs. So, the mission now, in terms of developing the best form of prioritarianism, is to extend this to non-identity cases. And I'm going to focus especially on this element, one element in this hybrid view, which is when we calculate the expected utility of a possible person, how do we deal with a state in which she doesn't exist? So suppose you have only a 50% chance of coming into existence. What is your expected utility? What, in what relevant sense, from the perspective of the currency of justice, should we take, you know, this element of the currency to be for you? So I'm going to look at two proposals. One is the state in which you don't exist is a zero, is equal to a zero. It's not that you have zero utility or well-being in that state because you don't exist. The proposal is rather more subtle, and it's developed and defended interestingly by Vlodek Rabinovich and Gustav Arrhenius, well known probably to many of you here, which is the following. Suppose that a person does come into existence. How does he or she value the state in which she exists compared to a state in which she never comes into existence? If, from the perspective of her own interest, she's glad to be alive, then she prefers existence to never having come into existence, and that allows you to give existence, so to speak, a positive score relative to non-existence. If she comes into existence and she would rather never have been, then you regard her life as worse than never having come into existence. And just at the point in between where you ask her, are you content with your existence, how do you compare your current existence vis-a-vis never having come into existence on your own behalf, where it's zero, where they're indifferent, you give the life a value of zero. So this is a view that I'm not going to defend, but I do think it's coherent. So the challenge has often been formulated by people like John Broom that it's incoherent to rank non-existence vis-a-vis existence. The proposal I think that they make is an interesting one, which is one could consider non-existence to be equivalent in value from the person's interest perspective to a state in which, if they did exist in that state, they wouldn't care whether they existed or not, or never existed. Okay, so that's one proposal. I'm going to reject it, but I think it's worth examining. The second proposal is that from the perspective of the currency of justice, we should focus only on her expected utility conditional on her existence. So we should not concern ourselves at all with valuing the state in which she doesn't come into existence. Only focus on the state or states in which she does exist. So, here's a case to try to tease the two apart. And who here has the worst prospects? Let's focus on what it says exactly. Either Jake or Casey will come into existence. Only one of the two of them. So only one person will exist. Jake has a 2/3 chance of existing. Casey has a 1/3 chance of existing. If Casey exists, she will be very well off. She will have 70 if you choose this prospect, or 80 if you choose that prospect. If Jake exists, he will be moderately well off, 40 or 50 if you choose this prospect, or just 40 if you choose the other prospect. So one way of thinking about this is, suppose the baseline is Casey gets 70, Jake gets 40, and you can do something which will give either Jake a 10 bonus with a 1/3 chance, right, move him from 40 to 50, or instead give Casey a bonus if she comes into existence, moving her from 70 to 80. Now, who here has the worst prospects? If we value non-existence at zero, then Casey has the worst prospects. Why? Because she has such a low chance of coming into existence compared to Jake. So, insofar as we're concerned with this expected utility element in our hybrid prioritarianism, we should choose prospect 12, because we're thereby compensating Casey for her low chance of coming into existence, so to speak. But if we instead focus on conditional expected utility, that's to say, how someone would fare if they were to come into existence, then Casey looks to be the best-off person. Why is that? Well, what is her conditional expected utility? You look only at the state in which she comes into existence, namely this state. She would either have 70 or 80. Now, what is Jake's conditional expected utility? You look only at the states in which he comes into existence. Well, here, his conditional expected utility would just be 40, because whenever he exists, he has 40. If you choose this, his conditional expected utility is 45. Right? Conditional on his existence, he has an expected utility of 45 here. So in that case, we would regard Jake as having relevantly worse prospects and would want to improve him, his situation, by giving the preparing the extra 10 utils for him rather than for Casey. This is a moment where you could ponder who you think is prospects are worse, more entitled to our attention insofar as we're concerned with people's prospects. Well, our view is this. We don't owe people compensation for a low chance of being born. So we think a case like this reveals that we ought to focus on conditional expected utility. In the relevant sense, Casey's situation is better because if she were to come into existence, she would be so much better off than Jake would be if he were instead to come into existence. So a case like this, and we have a few others, I'd be happy to discuss them in more detail, persuades us that insofar as we're concerned with people's prospects as part of the currency of justice, we should be concerned with their conditional prospects, their prospects conditional on existence. So this is what we get in terms of the best version of prioritarianism extended to our risky non-identity cases. Hybrid, the names are getting worse and worse. Hybrid final utility and conditional expected utility prioritarianism is, in our view, the most plausible version of prioritarianism, even if not the most lovely in terms of its name. But we have one objection to it. There's another one coming all the way at the end of the talk, but there's one at this stage, which to some of you who are familiar with our earlier critique will know it. Though it respects some difference between intra and interpersonal trade-offs, so it tracks some difference between the unity of the individual and the separateness of persons, it doesn't fully respect the unity of the individual in the following sense. Take one person case. Chad, either you expose him to this gamble of 50 and 70 plus something, there's our D again, or 60 for sure. Now, on our understanding of what these numbers mean, what does this mean? It means that for any D larger than zero, you would, on Chad's behalf, focusing only on his interests, prefer the first to the second. If you didn't, then you don't have the numbers right yet. On the definition of utility we're using, this has a larger expectation than this, just in case, focusing solely on his prudential interest, you would prefer this to that. So we think that prospect 3 is at least permissible for any such D larger than 0. In fact, I think it's even permissible for D is 0. But the final utility prioritarian component in the hybrid monster up here, right, tells you that for some such difference you should choose prospect 4. That is, you should choose contrary to what you think is in the expected interest of the person, the only person concerned, the only person whose well-being you're considering. Why? Not because this has greater value for the person, but because it has greater value, moral value, where this moral value is not personal value. This is a very interesting point. If we pursue this version of prioritarianism, we come to see that moral value is separate from personal value, and the pursuit of maximizing moral value, value from the perspective of the universe, will lead you to choose contrary to what you regard, given your knowledge, as the best interests of the only person concerned. This is the heart of what we regard as problematic with even the best version of prioritarianism. So that's our conclusion here. We have one more argument up our sleeve against prioritarianism. I'll save that special, exciting moment for the end of the talk. So, egalitarianism for possible people. Our argument will now be that egalitarianism avoids this problem and can also deal with the case with which we started. Now, there are many versions of egalitarianism. Egalitarians are concerned, sensible, moderate egalitarians, as they're sometimes called, care not just about equality, but also about improving people's well-being. So there, any sensible egalitarian view is pluralistic. Now, here's one pluralistic view. It's not the only one that I think is good, but it's especially useful in contexts of risk. It's called the equally distributed equivalent view. So what does it mean? Well, suppose we have Bert and Ernie, and they have 40 and 80 utils. And you can ask yourself, what would this equal utility have to be to make you indifferent, you, the distributor, indifferent between the unequal distribution and some hypothetical equal distribution? So, I don't know, for me it would probably be something in the mid-50s. So, 55, if I took this seriously and tried to understand exactly what these utils are. This is the equally distributed equivalent. And EDE, egalitarianism, basically says every distribution like this, unequal distribution or equal, can be assigned a number, a value, namely the value, its value, its moral value is the value of the equally distributed equivalent. So I would value this distribution as 55. So that's your simple egalitarian rule. Value every distribution by this number. Now, of course, such EDEs, mustn't be misled by the name, exist also for utilitarians. The utilitarian would be 60. Right? So in a sense, you can always give an answer to this question, but the answer is egalitarian in spirit when you're taking into account the relative position of the people in question. And you might think, well, prioritarian could give an answer here too. They might also say 55. Right? We'll see in a moment that when we turn to cases under risk, this view is clearly distinct from prioritarianism. So when there's no inequality, right, the EDE is equivalent to utilitarianism. That's why it's different from prioritarianism. And under risk, without any inequality, it simply maximizes expected utility. So this view is basically utilitarian when there's no inequality, averse to inequality when there is inequality, and departing from utilitarianism. So, I mean, just to give an example, I mean, if we want to think this through, the example of Chad, right, what does the egalitarian say of this kind about these two prospects? Well, there's no inequality here, so the value is 50. There's no inequality here, the value is 70 plus D. What's the expected value of prospect 3? Simply, half times 50, half times 70 plus D. That's from the EDE perspective, the expected value of prospect 3. The expected value of prospect 4 is just 60. So the expected value of this is higher than that, if you value it by this equally distributed equivalent. Now, we've already said that the currency of distributive justice, we can learn from what we did in part one in relation to prioritarians, is hybrid. We care not just about people's outcomes, but also about their prospects. For egalitarians, this is true as well. We must care not just about how people end up, but also about what their chances were. So the same case that we looked at before should establish also for an egalitarian that in valuing their chances when people may or may not exist, we have to focus on their conditional expected utility. So the proposal is that the currency of justice for an egalitarian should be some mix, my final utility in some state of the world, plus the expected utility conditional on my existence, and some way of combining them. That's all that psi means. How do we combine them? In other words, well, the currency of justice is neither outcomes nor prospects, but some combination of them. And what we should care about is the equal distribution of this combined hybrid currency of justice. And our question then becomes, how does a person's expected, conditional expected utility combine with their final utility into one measure of how they have fared in relation to the currency of justice. So here, I won't be providing any straightforward intuitive cases to argue that we have somewhere in our minds implicitly some function that combines these two in some ideal way. Instead, what I'm going to do is offer some considerations, some general considerations for a way of combining them, and show that that particular way of combining the two solves some problems for this egalitarian view, and that it coheres with a deeper justification of egalitarianism. So I don't here have one case that shows us, this is the way you have to combine the two. It's rather a more indirect argument. Consider first someone who has bad prospects but ends up okay. So at the moment of distribution, when you were deciding how to allocate resources, say it looked like this person's prospects were really very bad, and you're considering the situation in which the person ends up okay. They've gone through the eye of the needle and they've ended up in a good situation. It seems to me that when we're evaluating now, at the moment of decision, we don't yet know what's going to happen, that state of the world in which they had bad prospects but ended up okay, it should still count for quite a lot that their prospects were so bad. That isn't erased, so to speak. Of course, things ended up fine for them, but in terms of how they were treated in the currency of justice, it matters a lot that they had very poor prospects. On the other hand, suppose someone has excellent prospects but ends up badly. Here, it seems to me that the fact that they ended up badly is the main thing. The fact that they had excellent prospects matters some, but not very much. They had great prospects, but it didn't work out for them. So what this suggests, these are considerations rather than a knockdown argument, but what this suggests to us is that in this way in which conditional expected utility combines with final utility, it has diminishing marginal moral value. That's to say, having bad prospects matters quite a lot. Having good prospects doesn't matter as much. Or putting it this way, moving from bad to moderately good prospects is more important than moving from moderately good prospects to excellent prospects, even when we consider just one individual separately from how others fare. So what would follow is that this is concave. You can imagine a person's utility plus like the square root of his conditional expected utility. Now, how does that help us? It helps us with our initial case. Remember that in the initial case, the claim was egalitarians can find no reason, that was Mike Otsuka's claim, to favor prospect 2 over prospect 1, even though we ought to favor prospect 2. Why can they find no such reason? Well, because there is no inequality between any two coexisting individuals in this case. And even more, EDE egalitarians say when there's no inequality, one ought to maximize each person's expected utility, right? So we're utilitarians when there's no inequality. So the problem becomes even worse. It would look like one would have to be indifferent between the two prospects if one was an egalitarian. If, however, we do this complex move where we say we care about both how a person ends up and about her prospects conditional on her existence, and having moderately good rather than bad prospects matters more than having excellent rather than moderately good prospects, we can arrive at the desired verdict here of that prospect 2 is favored. So as I said, there's no inequality in any view of the world. So our egalitarian view can't refer to the badness of inequality in this case, but it can refer to the following. In this prospect, Anne, final utility is 50. Her conditional expected utility is 50 as well. Bob's final and conditional expected utility are the same. If we go for prospect 2, we move her final utility up and Bob's final utility down. Because there's no inequality, we value this improvement as just as much as this improvement in final utility. But instead, we say, moving from, say, moderate to good prospects, conditional prospects, rather than from good to very good prospects, this move is more valuable than this move. So it's the importance of the conditional prospect being good rather than moderately good, as opposed to excellent rather than moderately good, which does the work in our egalitarian view. In other words, there's an element of, you might say, expected utility prioritarianism being smuggled into our egalitarian view. We take one element of prioritarianism, which is the diminishing marginal moral value of an increase in a person's expectations, and plug that into our egalitarian view, and we get the desired result. Now, that way of putting it may make it seem very ad hoc and problematic. So, here's the objection. This is ad hoc. Where does this come from? Well, I think at this point, we have to acknowledge that it's not an egalitarian idea that is doing any work here. But at the same time, that it's not ad hoc. The reason is that we can justify this by an appeal to the idea, the very same idea which justifies egalitarianism. Namely, the difference between intra and interpersonal trade-offs and gambles. The difference between the unity of the individual and the separateness of persons. So that's what I'll now try to do. Consider the following case. Again, only one person will come into existence. If you choose prospect 19, either Rita or Sam will come into existence. If Rita comes into existence, she has a moderately good life. If Sam comes into existence, he has a fantastic life. Okay? So only one person will exist. Imagine for a moment that this will be your child, and you get the news. You'll have one child. It will either be Rita, her life will be moderately good, or Sam's life, his life will be fantastic. Or instead, the following thing, you get Theo for sure. Theo's life will either be moderately good or fantastic. Now, in the first instance, one could say something like this. The prospects of your child, where your child doesn't refer to any given individual, but whoever will occupy the position of your child, are good. But that would be misleading, because there is no single individual whose prospects are good. We have one individual with moderate prospects, one individual with fantastic prospects, one possible individual. In this case, however, it would make sense to say the prospects of your child are good. Now we know that in the end, this final utility will either be 50 or 90, but there is a person who has moderately good prospects. So a choice like this is a choice between an interpersonal gamble and an intrapersonal gamble. It's not a trade-off in the following sense. We can never make anyone better off than they otherwise would have been, right, in choosing between these two. So I'm using the word intrapersonal and interpersonal gamble advisedly here. Now, what would a utilitarian say? For a utilitarian, it makes no difference whether these are two separate potential individuals or one single potential individual. Now, I think this is problematic, that utilitarianism in this case is problematic. If I were to, choose between Prospect 19 and Prospect 20 on behalf of any child that I might get, I would choose Prospect 20. Why? Because at least if things end up not as well as they might, I gave this child decent prospects. Whichever child I get will have had decent prospects. Whereas here, if things end up badly, that child will never have had better prospects. Now, there's nothing I can do on behalf of Rita, so to speak. So that's not the thought. The thought is rather that the intrapersonal amalgamation of my child's prospects is permissible here but not here, and this difference in their prospects is significant in a way that there are no differential prospects here. So I think that the difference between intra and interpersonal gambles makes the utilitarian approach inappropriate here, and note that this is precisely what our view, which says that conditional expected utility has diminishing marginal moral importance, would recommend. It would say this improvement is more important than this improvement, so you should choose Prospect 20. Now, I recognize that this case may elicit either no judgments or contrary judgments or puzzlement in a lot of you. I've seen some of the amused looks already. And I think it's correct that it should elicit less strong judgments in us than many of the typical cases we consider in distributive ethics. Why is that? The typical case is Anne at 50, Bob at 70, or Anne and Bob both at 60. Okay? A typical case like that involves people coexisting, there being inequalities between them, and there being, so to speak, ways of making the worse off better off than you otherwise would do. Okay? So several moral factors which determine and push our judgment in a very clear direction in standard cases: competition between the less well-off and the better-off, the possibility and the fact that they coexist and that there's perhaps problematic inequalities between them and that you can get rid of. Those things do not exist here. This is not an interpersonal trade-off case. The question is, does anything remain when we strip away those normally present and strongly influencing elements in our distributive judgments? And I think, yes, there is still something that remains, though less strong than when everything is present, though all those other factors are present. What remains is the difference between intra and interpersonal gambles. The fact that here, it would be some sense of a mistake to say your child's prospects are good, whereas here, that makes perfect sense. Okay. So, we're almost at the end. How am I doing for time? The hybrid EDE, my favorite egalitarian view, gets all the cases so far considered and the 20 other cases we consider in the paper, for which I apologize, so far correct. And I think that rather than being ad hoc, the element in it that is not strictly egalitarian, the smidgen, the little flavoring of ex-anti-prioritarianism that we pop in there, right, makes perfect sense, coheres with the underlying rationale of the view, which is the difference between intra and interpersonal trade-offs and gaps. So, I promised one final argument against prioritarianism. So, it's this. You might be think it's unsurprising that we should think that prioritarianism isn't sensitive to inequality, but we think this issue emerges in an interesting way. Remember that I just said when we were discussing the previous case, normally when we consider cases in distributive justice, we have one person being less well off than another, and their interests compete. I've just shown you cases in which those two factors are absent. Now, here's a claim about the difference between those cases. When we have the standard distributive cases, one person less well off than another, and their interests compete, we have very strong reason to move resources from the better off to the less well off. When, however, there is no such inequality, our reasons are much weaker. In fact, if the puzzled looks and skepticism that I saw just a moment ago when I displayed the previous case are right, you would agree with that statement at least, right? Our reasons are weaker when those standard factors are absent. Okay, so it's that's what I'm now going to speak about. That the presence or absence of those factors which are standardly present in distribution cases should make a difference to how much reason we have to move resources from the better off to the less well off. So I'm going to define a term which you're probably familiar with, a leaky transfer. A leaky transfer means there's a loss in total expected utility if we move it from one person to another. So this is standardly known in economics. If I tax the rich and give it to the poor, then if the rich work less hard, etc., then I might have the cake as a whole, the pie might shrink, even though I'm giving more to the less well off. Here's my claim, which I just made a moment ago, but I'll give it in an example as well. We should accept a larger leak, a greater loss in utility, when a transfer alleviates significant inequality than when it doesn't. So here's a case where, of the standard kind, the one that we most often consider when we look at cases of distributive justice, two people, Ua and Vera, either Ua has 50, Vera 70, or you give them both 60 minus D. D is a measure of the loss. Let D be the point, choose D so that you're indifferent. So for me, I guess it would be something like 8. Right? I'd be prepared to sacrifice quite a lot of total utility in order to improve the situation the least well off here. Okay? I'm happy to accept a large loss because, in part, there is this significant inequality and the transfer improves the situation of the least well off. Now, let's go to a case in which only one person exists. So there is no such inequality among coexisting individuals. One person at 50, one possible person if he comes into existence will be at 50, Xenia if she comes into existence will be at 70, or instead prospect 24, 60 minus D. Now, if you're a prioritarian of the type we think is the best form of prioritarianism, whatever D in the first case you thought was the indifference point should be the same one here. You can, I won't go through it, but you can work it out, basically. Because it's all about the difference in value between 50 and 60 minus D, and the difference in value between 60 minus D and 70. For the prioritarian, it doesn't matter whether these people coexist or not, whether they have competing claims or not. All those things are irrelevant from the prioritarian point of view. It's just about the difference in moral value of moving from one level to another level. In other words, no difference between the preceding case that I showed you and this one. But my view is, here we should accept a much more modest leak. Why? Because there is no inequality between the individuals in question. And that means one of the reasons we have in order to move resources from the better off to the less well off is absent. So this complex pair of cases is meant to establish the following. We have more reason to move resources from the better off and benefit thereby the less well off when people coexist than when they do not coexist. If you accept that, then we have to reject prioritarianism. So in fact, in the end, we have two arguments against the prioritarian view. One is that it doesn't fully respect the unity of the individual. It doesn't allow you to maximize expected utility when only one person's interests are at issue. The second is it's insensitive to whether the people to whom, the worse-off individuals whom you can help out, coexist with other individuals who are better off than they, or whether they instead exist only in different possible futures. Okay, so let's conclude. I've argued for the best view is this hybrid of conditional expected utility and final utility egalitarianism. That the foundation of this is this distinction between intrapersonal and interpersonal gambles and trade-offs. When we're dealing only in intrapersonal gambles or trade-offs without inequality, we should simply do what's prudentially best for the person, maximize their expected utility. For interpersonal gambles, we should care for those who have worse prospects. And we should have a larger acceptable leak when this alleviates more significant inequality. So, to sum it up, there's a claim about the currency of justice. One part of the currency of justice is conditional expected utility, and the way to distribute this currency is equality and not priority, or in a slogan, equality, not priority for possible people. Thanks.